very eloquently put. Now I've got to follow that. That's not fair. No, thank you for such a lovely introduction, and you know, quite glorious for us to be mentioned in the same breath as Footprint. So I'd like to pass my personal thank you to Jeff for joining us this evening, and it's great to present this event as part of the wonderful Writing on the Wall Festival. Before I start, just very quickly, I'll tell you what we're going to do in terms of the structure of this session. We're going to do a bit of Q&A between myself and Jeff now for, I don't know, about 40 minutes. Take a quick break, Stuart's going to play some records in the bar, and then we'll come back and we've got a special treat for you where Jeff's going to select some records from Roughtrade's back catalogue. We're going to have a chat about them, and then we're going to open the floor up to questions from yourselves. So I'd like to start off, if it's all right, just by asking, taking you back to the start of Roughtrade, the start of the adventure and the journey, and the record shop. What was the kind of the motivation behind it? I suppose if you think back to that time, why did the idea of a record shop appeal? And I suppose what did you hope to kind of achieve with it?
Quite a long story, really. I mean, when I finished college, I mean, I was brought up in London, and I was born in 1952, a long, long time ago, so I was about sort of 12, 13, 14 when the Beatles started, and the Rolling Stones, and the Kinks, and the Who, and the Yardbirds, and Otis Redding, and Martha Reeves, and the Vandellas, and the Supremes. It was a pretty good time to be a young teenager, and there really wasn't any radio to listen to except for pirate radio stations, which we used to listen to on those tiny transistor radios after you've done your homework or not done your homework, go to bed, your parents think you've gone to sleep, they've turned the lights out, and then you put the radio on under the pillow and you listen to Radio London. You hear John Peel on a show called Perfume Garden, like 10 o'clock till midnight. And Kevin Shields has said this before, the thing about listening to pirate radio is the signal coming from the North Sea, it was actually quite poor, so it would kind of fade in and out. And he said that was the inspiration for the sound of Loveless. If you think about, you know, Sooner, that track Sooner on Loveless, it felt, got that lovely spindly fading in and out feeling to it, which is dislocates you. So that was interesting, he said that. So Kevin's older than you think. In a wine shop, I mean, I, you know, when I finished college, I had no idea what to do. I remember standing there in the hall of the college that I was at, actually completely perplexed. I was quite enjoyed it. I thought, they're throwing me out now. What the hell am I going to do? I really had no idea. I mean, I thought about being an academic. I could have been an academic. But I knew some postgraduate students, and they all seemed very lonely, you know. They all seemed like they didn't really have anyone to talk to, especially they had no one to talk to about their subjects except for their professors and tutors. And even then, they kind of surpassed them in the knowledge. So it just felt a bit wrong, really. So I didn't do that. But I really, really loved music. And growing up in London at that time, you know, I used to go to the Marquee after school with my school sector and get in the queue. And I saw The Who, and I saw John Mayall's Blues Breakers with Peter Green, and there were things like that, which was just amazing. And I saw the Soft Machine play at the Country Club in Havistock Hill, down a little alleyway into a dark cavern, and there was Robert White playing drums and singing. I mean, that's Nirvana to me. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm just one of these people that loved to save up my pocket money and would go to the electrical shop that sold fridges and toasters, and go through to the back, and there'd be a little store selling singles, and I'd save up my pocket money and buy singles. So I was an addict of music, really. I love music. And so when I finished college, I thought, what am I going to do? I don't know. And eventually I went down to London, lived in a squat for a while, and went to teach training college. I had an idea that feminism was a very important thing to me when I was at university. All the women I knew were feminists and quite militant, and they opened my mind to the fact that, you know, there was another 50% of the population that had their own ideas and very good ideas. And maybe us men should take some notice of that. And that was a big thing for me. So I thought maybe what I would do, go to teacher training college, become a teacher, drama teacher, and start a men's theatre group and tour around the country and do a play about sexual education or feminism, but from a male point of view, to try to explain feminism from a male point of view. I thought no one was doing that. Probably still not doing that. Yeah, that was the idea. But so I went to teacher training college for a while, and you know, I had a big afro, so no one really liked me very much.
No afro.
I started teaching in a school in Mill Hill, and it was really interesting. I would give these lessons to the girls. It was great. And I was sort of teaching them about signing on, you know, and what it was like when you do little plays. And every time I walked into the staff room, I sort of felt this chill. A kind of, you know, frisson of disapproval. And I sort of realised that actually the kids were great, but this wasn't really me. So I was waiting at a bus stop. I've told this story before. And I read this stupid book called The Dice Man by Luke Ryan. It's a really stupid book. And you roll the dice and if it comes up a certain thing, you make a decision and you stick with it, even though it's stupid. And the decision was to leave. No, it wasn't to leave. It was, if the bus doesn't come to take you to school to teach in the next 5 minutes, then I'm going to quit. And the bus didn't come, and I quit. I didn't go to school, and I went on, got on a plane the next day, went to Montreal to see an old girlfriend. And I lived in a theatre in Montreal. It was a theatre where my old drama teacher, the girl I was going out with was the daughter of our school drama teacher. I went to see her, and the drama teacher, Barbara, let me live in the attic of the drama school in Montreal. The thing was, it was a bit weird because they locked it up when they'd finished. I was there on my own in the night time. Couldn't really get out, but it's cheap. Anyway, so then I went to Chicago, and I went to Toronto to see some other friends, and I met a girl in Chicago called Penny, and we got together and we went down to Chicago, and it was really good. We stayed there for a while. We used to go to this cinema called the Biograph, and it was one of those great art cinemas where they changed the film every 2 days. A doubleheader is a great film, you know, Buñuel and Renoir and Ozu and everything. And you go and see great films, and they change them around. They don't really do that so much anymore. So we saw lots of films, and the Biograph was where Al Capone was shot, right in the foyer, so it's quite romantic, in a sadistic way. And then we hitchhiked to San Francisco. And we went to San Francisco because we wanted to go to City Lights Bookshop, and where Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I mean, I read a lot. I was a big reader. And I loved really the Beats, but even more than the Beats, I like William Carlos Williams and you know, a certain amount of William Burroughs and Black Mountain poets, Charles Olson, and people like that. Really, and I like the British poets like Tom Raworth and Tom Garland. But I wanted to go to City Lights to see Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and I went to City Lights. We got there eventually. Everyone who picked us up on that long trip from Chicago to San Francisco said, "You're crazy. You know, your kids are crazy. What are you doing? You're getting yourselves killed." But we didn't get killed. We got there safely. And in San Francisco, I found that along that journey, I bought a lot of records. You know, in Salvation Army stores and thrift stores and all the way. I mean, really, I sort of carried them under my arm. I got to San Francisco and stayed in this flat in Haight-Ashbury with some friends. And it was long past the heyday of Haight-Ashbury.
Right.
It was pretty seedy. It was pretty horrible in many ways. It was kind of like a rundown. It was like the party had happened a week before and no one had grown up yet. And I still saw Juno playing Golden Gate Park, that was good, but it was a kind of over. But the bookshop was great. And of course, Lenny Bruce had been there as well, doing his nightclub act in a year or two previously, and that was an allure. But City Lights, a great bookshop. And I just thought, you know, I love that bookshop. Spent all my lives in record shops, basically, buying records and going to thousands of gigs. I mean, every Sunday we would go to the Roundhouse in London, to a thing called Implosion. It's a long answer, I told you. It cost about 60 pence to get in. It was 3:30 in the afternoon to 11:30 at night, and it was in the Roundhouse, same Roundhouse as now, but it was all kind of wooden tiers and bean bags and brown rice, you know, it's loads of hippies. And you go in there and it's pitch black and you sit on the floor and you stay there and it's amazing. And Jeff Dexter's playing these great records, and there'd be just fantastic bands playing. The Who played there on a double bill with Elton John a couple of nights. The Stones played, Rolling Stones played 3 nights there. And Love played there in the For Sale album period. Yeah. That's one of the few times they played in England during that period. That's great.
Hardly played.
Exactly. And that was an education. That was our church. Instead of going to church on Sunday, we'd go to Implosion every single week. We didn't even think about it. So it was exciting, actually. So I was in San Francisco, I had a pile of records in this flat, and a guy from Newcastle that was there called Ken Davidson said, "What are you going to do with those records?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well,
there's quite a lot of them. How are you going to get them back to England? What are you going to do with them when they get back there? I said, I don't really know. I haven't thought about it. He said, why don't you start a shop? It was his idea. And I thought, you know what? It's a really good idea. Because what would be better than actually working but to be in a shop? You could just play music all day. That was the idea. It was the it was how to avoid getting a proper job in the real world. It really was, you know.
So what was it about?
It was pre-punk. It was literally, you know, it was probably about a year before punk really started.
Right. What was it about City Lights specifically? I mean, what?
City Lights, what I liked about it was, first of all, it had great books, had a great poetry section, it had brilliant modern novels, and best of all, it had a downstairs section where you could sit in an armchair and read all day long, and they wouldn't throw you out. And this was the polar opposite to like Virgin Records and Oxford Street, which was good, but they'd throw you out, didn't buy anything.
It's really interesting, that idea of kind of a long, kind of drawn out kind of road trip informing kind of the record shop and what it became, which is really similar to Jeff, who started Probe in Liverpool, who hitchhiked around India, and then ended up coming back and starting a head record shop.
Jeff Dean is one of my favourite people that I've ever met in music, Jeff.
He's a really, really inspiring character.
Ken started this shop with me, and we had a false start where we started it in the wrong location, but we moved eventually. Well, we were in this place in Harlesden, and we were always living in squats in London at the time, so we didn't have any money, but we didn't really need any money, we just needed money to eat, that was the thing. In that period, you could squat, and everybody knew you were squatting. So that was a great thing, because that enabled you to not have to worry about getting a real job. We found this shop and in a little parade in North London in Harlesden, and we started sort of standing down the wall so we could open a shop there. And then one day, you know, we made some contacts with labels to try and buy some records. And one day, a guy came in from Polydor, and he said to us, "What are you doing here?" And we said, "You know, really enthusiastically, we're starting a record shop." And he said, "Well, there's no passing trade." And we said, "What do you mean?" "What's that?" And he says, "You know why he's right? There's no one walking past this place. There's a few rustlers because it was quite near the Apollo, which was a little kind of shebeen. But there were no people. There was like a grocery store, you know, one of those things selling plantains."
Right.
And that was it. So we jumped back in the car and drove around, and we saw a wagon wheel outside 202 Gaston Park Road. And that looked interesting. We went in there and we found out it used to be an old print shop, and then in the 60s it'd been a head shop, which meant it was actually the place probably where someone like Jimi Hendrix would have gone, because he lived around the corner for a while. He would have gone in and bought his rolling papers or his paraphernalia. So that, we thought that was really a sign that was meant for us. So we rented that and we opened the shop. But Ken, after about 3 weeks of working in the shop, Ken started disappearing in the afternoons. And I thought, this is a bit odd. I wonder where he's off to. And he said, "Ken, where were you yesterday?" He said, "I went to play tennis." Is this really showing commitment? Anyway, so the thing about Ken was, he'd actually been in a band in Newcastle with Hilton Valentine. And Hilton Valentine, for those nerds, will know that he was the original guitarist in The Animals. So I was really impressed by that. So dear old Ken left, but we carried on. But nobody really came for ages, like the first 3 months. We were in Kensington Park Road, now it's parallel to Portobello Road. Portobello Road, we couldn't afford the rents there, it was impossible. That's where actually people walked along. Kensington Park Road was a synagogue, a garage, a little old Polish lady across the road with a deli, long before anyone knew there was any Polish people in England. And Doris next door in a sweet shop, who was sort of a bit senile, and barricaded herself in behind the counter that sold lollipops and things, and that was our street. It was pretty bizarre and run down, you know. So nobody really came until some word got around in London that there was an interesting shop.
The whole idea of the shop being kind of part of a counterculture, part of a alternative view of the world, and kind of having a really strong kind of fanzine culture and literature culture as part of it, seems that was central to the vision, was it, at that time?
I think you know, I always loved fanzines and always read fanzines. I mean, things like Cream and Greg Shaw's, who put the Bomb, and Bam Blam in Scotland and Zigzag and Let It Rock and all those progenitors of the fanzine that Mark Perry wrote, Sniffing Glue, those were all really important. We had all those in the shop. I mean, we were lucky in London because there was an absolutely incredible shop in Camden High Street called Compendium. Right. And Compendium was one of the best bookshops there's ever been. It was just phenomenal. And that's sadly gone now. But that was a place that was a treasure trove of things that you didn't really dream about. You could find the most interesting, you know, books of every stripe, really. And in a way, we were trying to copy that a little bit as well as City Lights. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing about, we wanted to be in the community. We wanted to participate in the community. We didn't want to be, we had no aspirations to be successful. We weren't in the music industry. We weren't in the music business. We just wanted to create a safe haven where people could come and hear great music. I mean, we had these fantastic reggae speakers, and we just pumped out music. You couldn't even hear what people were trying to buy half the time. But it didn't really matter. I mean, the shop got so packed after a while. But yeah, I mean, anybody that was doing anything, the whole point was to encourage them. And, you know, we let people put together their fanzines in the back. There's a little shed in the back, in the backyard, and, you know, we'd invite people to come in. The thing that we did, too, that was really good was that when someone came in, like, say, John Savage came in, London Burning, his fanzine, had 50 of them, we'd buy them all. The thing is, we'd pay for them on the spot.
Right.
We wouldn't say, right, we'll take them, Levy, and then come back in a year's time. If we've sold one, we'll give you some money. We paid for them straight away, and we would be people's records as well. And we knew that everybody was skinned, and we knew that if we did that, it would give them a chance to do something else or print some more. And we always did that. I don't think we really hardly ever made a mistake. I mean, it's not that we left any stock of anything. You know, so I think that was principle that not many other people were really following. It's not really a business principle, is it?
No, but it's definitely a philosophical standing point, absolutely. So was there a moment with the shop where it went from being the two of you there, well, you in the morning, the two of you in the morning playing tennis in the afternoon, was there a moment where people started arriving and kind of like...
They did slowly. I mean, the thing we realised that we... you know, it's quite good fun. In those days, there's no internet, okay, so... In order to track down good records, you have to do some work. So, you know, you might hear a record on the radio. So let's say you heard I'm Stranded by the Saints, which is a very important record. And it was, you know, John Ingham wrote about it, Sing of the Week in the Sounds, it's probably Sing of the Week in the Enemy. I mean, there was four music papers then, remember? There was a lot of information, a lot of space had to be filled up. But John Peel was playing, you know, was on the radio, and he was critical, everybody listened to him. So when you play a record like that, then you'd have to write a letter to Australia. You know, you'd have to, you know, and to try and say, you know, write to the Saints and say, can we buy it? I remember writing letters to this guy in Cleveland called Crocus Behemoth. And that was David Thomas, you know, Perubu, and they released their own first three singles on Half, and some of the best three singles ever released, you know, Final Solution and the other two, amazing, amazing records. And writing to David and, you know, buying the records and sending him a postal order for them. And it was good fun, you know, Terry Ork in New York and buying Alex Chilton's Can't Seem to Make Your Mind, buying, you know, Little Johnny Jewel, really, like buying 100 copies of Little Johnny Jewel and then a week later buying another 100. And that's, you communicate, it's quite nice to write letters. People don't really do it anymore, but they should. So yeah, I mean, that was the fun, like being a detective, is tracking down these things. And also we had a great people in Parade Street in Paddington, two French guys, and they had a label called Skydog, and they would import things that were slightly illegal, like Iggy Pop single, Sick of You, bootleg, Velvet Underground EP, with Mo Tucker singing I'm Sticking With You on it. Really great EP, everyone might have heard that. And they put out Metallic KO, which was the great Iggy and Stooges bootleg. And they bought in the first Flaming Groovies singles as well, the 10-inch. And so all those things were critical for the shop. And the thing was that having all those records in the shop, not many other people had them. So that's what word sort of got around, people started to come in. Also, the 101ers were playing Around the Corner, which was Joe Strummer's band before we joined the Clash. And Richard Dudansky played in there, he later played in Pill. And a guy called Mole, who's still around Portobello, and he played bass. But I mean, and, you know, people came to work in the shop. I mean, Shirley and Anna from the Raincoats came to work in the shop, Epic, and Nikki from the Swan Maps came down and worked in the shop. It was a bit like having a flat, you know, but people wanted to come around, and certain people just wouldn't leave. But if you liked them enough, you let them stay. So that was what it was like.
So within how long?
It was about 6 months before punk really started.
It was about 6 months. Yeah.
So.
And then at what point was the idea of a label floated? I mean, where did that always sit into the vision of what you were gonna
Well, you know, to be really honest with you, I don't think we had any vision. The vision was to create a space where we could listen to music all day. And then after that, when we started to see that by having good stuff in the shop, and that, you know, people would come back, and people started doing things, and because we were encouraging them to, and other people were encouraging them to around the country as well, it wasn't only us. I mean, we felt like it's actually Richard Scott and the guy called Stuart's idea to start a mail order. Because we had these records and no one else had them, and other people wanted them. And then out of the mail order, very quickly, we had the idea that we should really start a distribution, because there is no alternative distribution. And the books that you saw in Compendium or in City Lights, you wouldn't find them in many other bookshops. And if you go into the high street to Smith's, you couldn't find any interesting left-wing literature. There was no feminist literature. You know, it was the usual thing. So it felt that the world was, your thoughts and how you were meant to be as a human being were being dictated to by the establishment. You know what it's like. Imagine if it was just Fox News every night, Sky News every night, nothing else, no alternative. We'd probably all succumb to sort of brainwashing very quickly. That's obviously what's happening, but we realised that the only way, we didn't want to join the system. We thought that what Marx had said about owning the means of production was actually a very sensible thing. And then if we could own the means of production, then we could decide what it was that people had access to. They could decide if they wanted to buy it or not. So that was the thought that we had, and that's why we started the distribution. And we identified the fact that London is great, but everyone who doesn't live in London doesn't feel the same way about it. So the thing to do is to decentralise, to empower the, you know, everywhere else. So it was a very conscious idea to set up a cartel, which was a joke. I mean, Rough Trade, the name is a joke, really. And so Edinburgh, Bristol, York, Pete Stennett, Small Wonder in Walthamstow, and a few others around the country, like Jeff Davis at Probe, people with the same attitude to us. I mean, Jeff saw the Beatles before they got bad, in his opinion. you know, so, and so when we had a record, like, let's say we had a Richard Hell single, and we would, instead of buying 50 for the shop, we'd buy 500 and sell the rest around the country. Yeah. And we started a distribution system, and then we started to encourage, when Desperate Bicycles, they were the first. Desperate Bicycles was the first do-it-yourself single. And, you know, they wrote on the sleeve how you make a single. And from that record, that inspired Squitty Flitty, and it inspired so many other people to go and record their own singles. And then people would bring them to the shop, and then, or not only to our shop, anyone of the tentacles of distribution. So, you know, the wedding present could go to see Tony at Red Rhino in New York. The Sugar Cubes could get on the boat from Iceland and go to a branch of a Red Rhino and Leamington Spa and take in their birthday single. And that would then join the international system, and the United Kingdom system. And it was a distribution system that had enough power that you could have a hit. If your record was going to be a hit, you could have a hit. And so Mute could sell millions of Depeche Mode records, Erasure records. Tony and Rob could sell Joy Division records. I mean, I said this earlier. I mean, Tony, well, I mean, Ian Curtis, as you most likely know, he wanted Joy Division to be on RCA because Iggy was on RCA and David Bowie was on RCA, so it was a natural thought. But and Tony Wilson was all prepared to sign Joy Division to RCA. But Rob Gretton, who was this Manchester City supporting hooligan that loved music, who became the manager, said to Tony, no, let's do it ourselves and go and see Jeff and we'll distribute for Rough Trade. And Rob Gretton really is the man that started Factory by saying that to Tony. And, you know, and that was a great thing, but unless that distribution was in place, that couldn't have been said. And the distribution wasn't in place when the Clash signed to CBS. And we all thought, well, that's really stupid, you know. Why are you doing that, guys?
Do you think at that time when you started when you started putting out those early singles on Rough Trade, were you thinking about kind of like A&R and developing artists and kind of, you know, thinking about kind of like a
Was it being the mother of necessity? I mean, what happened was Metal and Ban had a single out called Panic, Lady Coca-Cola, and John Peel played it. And we really, really liked it. And they were kind of like Sex Pistols of France for a second. And we liked it. So we wrote to Paris, we got the address, and wrote to them and said, can we buy 50 copies of your single? And here's the money. And they were just amazed that anyone liked them, because everyone hated them in France. And that anybody in another country would buy their record. We did that, we sold a few hundred of their single. And then one day they walked into the shop, the whole group, right. Eric and Herman and everybody, and they said to maybe Pete Dunne, who was standing behind the counter, we've got this tape, we want it to be a single, well, we've got no money, can you help? So that was the moment when we thought, well, we like these guys, why don't we help them and try and do it? And we knew that, you know, Ted Carroll and Roger Armstrong at Chiswick had already started the label. They'd put out the 101 as Keys to Your Heart scene, which we loved, and the Count Bishops and the Pop Story and various things. And down up the road was Stiff Records, and up the road from us on Portobello and Vernon Jarre was Virgin Records. And we knew these people by now, we knew them, and we thought to ourselves arrogantly, well, they don't really know more about music than we do. I mean, they may know more about business, but the music's the important part. So we thought, okay, we'll do it. So that really milieu of there being under labels in London was what inspired us to do it, really, because other people were doing it. I mean, we didn't think, right, we're going to start a label and it's going to be the best label in the history of the world and we're going to have this philosophy or that philosophy. But the philosophy of the music that we've released, I hope, exemplifies in sounds and in those grooves all these things that I'm talking about that we wanted to do and how we wanted to be in the world. I mean, we never, ever have signed somebody to be a success. In fact, we've turned down so many groups that have sold millions of records because we didn't like them, or we didn't really like their philosophy, or we didn't like their politics. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's good.
Yeah, it is. It's probably acting. Yeah.
Stupid.
Gloriously refreshing, you know, it's yeah. I mean, and then that's where the longevity comes in, that's what people fall in love with, and that comes through in the artists that you...
I mean, after a while, you get a bit egotistical and you think, oh, well, I really, you know, want our label to be growing. But, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of an everyday thing, really. It seems like a work in progress, really.
It looks like, now, when you look at the kind of chronology of the shop start, the label start, and then Cartel, was in quite a small period of time. It must have been quite an intensely kind of creative period around
that. It was. I mean, we were lucky, really, because, you know, our first album, Stiff Little Fingers album, sold 100,000 copies in literally 3 weeks.
And that is just nuts when you think.
I mean, it's, you know, it's just nowadays it's almost unthinkable. And so that, you know, that gave us an incredible start because that created enough cash flow for us to do so many other things with the label because things weren't expensive to do. I mean, Mayo Thompson and I produced that Stiff Little Fingers album. We did it in 6.5 days in a studio in Cambridge called Spacewood, and it kind of cost more than about $2,500.
How many did you think it was going to sell when you released it?
We had no idea.
Right.
It was all new to us, really.
How many did you practice?
We weren't really thinking like that. I mean, I think, well, they put out their first single themselves, Stiff Little Fingers single, which we then sort of took over, and we did Alternative Ulster, and that sold literally about 30,000 really quickly. It was a really big record at the time for us. So we probably did press about 30,000 albums. They were popular, they were a great live band.
So
they weren't very cool though. They were like in a second wave really.
With Cartel, how did you kind of galvanise that kind of group of disparate kind of independent souls?
Everyone was similar, everyone had the same kind of sort of rebel spirit really, and the people that were running these shops, you know, Jeff and Tony, Red Rhino and Robin Hurley and Lloyd and Revolver and Pete. Everyone was the same, really. Everyone was not. Everyone was kind of outsiders in the sense that none of them wanted to engage with the normal world, and they wanted to make a living out of the thing they loved, basically. And they all recognised that this music was important, and they loved it. They embraced it. I mean, you know, some people stopped. You know, there's a survey just came out a week ago where they said people who reach the age of 33 stop listening to new music. Well, it didn't apply to any of us, and none of you here as well, I'm sure. So, yeah, so it's finding like-minded people. I mean, the power is in the collective, you know. It really wasn't what I did, it was what a whole collection of people did together that really counted, and that was what gave it power, and creating that system. I mean, no one had any idea that it was going to create so many hit records. No one had any idea that, you know, 4AD would have a number one record. Nobody knew that Depeche Mode were going to sell millions of records. I mean, there was a moment, I remember Tony Wilson's, we put out the Swell Maps album, which was our second album, I think, the same time that Tony and Rob put out the Joy Division album. We were joking about which one was going to sell the most. And after about 2 weeks, we were ahead for a minute. Then we lost.
Because I think in some ways there's an interesting kind of comparison around the idea of as a distribution organisation trying to galvanise what on the face of it are quite disparate kind of single-minded kind of driven individuals. There's an interesting comparison there between the idea of that and a record label and kind of an artist who are by their very nature individual with a view of the world and a way of kind of working towards something. Bringing them, the idea of kind of collective independence, which Rough Trade completely embodies. I mean, do you think that because Rough Trade has always stood for that idea, that kind of idea of bringing people together, do you think that's made it really palatable from an artist's perspective, as well as the amazing back catalogue and what Rough Trade means in the world, but because that's at the core of what Rough Trade stands for?
Well, I think, you know, it all comes down to people, doesn't it, really? It comes down to the way that you are with another human being and how you relate to them and what you say and how you treat them and how much respect you give them. And I think musicians are really unusual, interesting creatures, aren't they? I mean, they're very schizophrenic, the best ones, you know, I can't sing, they say, I'll put my vocals down lower in the mix, but your voice is amazing, why would you want to do that? You know, you have to talk them, you have to be a therapist continuously as an A&R person. I mean, it's a difficult job, really. I mean, the hardest job is being manager. You know, because then you get the phone call at 4 o'clock in the morning, we've missed our plane. Well, sorry, but what do you want me to do? I don't know, but I think, you know, I think if you sign to a major label, you know, there's lots of people in majors that love music. But it's a different world, you know, it's a different world. The only thing that really counts is success, really. And success is very hard to find. I mean, the last 20 years have been very, very tough for anyone trying to release records. Because it's kind of completely collapsed, the sales. I mean, people who know much more than I do are saying optimistic things about the future. You know, but who knows? It's been tough. I mean, selling that number of records, you know, I mean, we would sell 20,000 of a single quite regularly, and probably today that would probably sell 2,000 of the same ones, which is a bit tragic because that doesn't really support anyone's life as a musician. But I mean, the whole of independent culture is populated by people that care about what they do and care about their artists and care about them as people beyond whether they're just a product, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a big part of life, isn't it? Being able to care about other people, contributing something towards their well-being and their happiness.
Yeah.
But by the same token, I mean, if you're running a label, you're also in a relationship with an artist, which is slightly unusual in that, in a sense, you know, it's a commercial relationship as well. You can't really pretend that they're your best friend. But what you're trying to do is to create a milieu where they feel competitive with their peers and their best peers, so they do better work than they think they can do. And your job as an A&R person is to try to help them sustain their creativity and create a safe space in their minds. They don't have to worry about all the things that people worry about, like, are my records in the shops, or is this being taken care of, and that. Because it's very hard to be a creative person and to deal with everyday reality. It's a difficult thing, and I think I really respect people that are really good at it, and people don't realise how hard it is to be a working musician and to go on tour and drive around in a minibus with seven other people, you know, for 4 weeks in a row and come back with nothing, you know. It's not easy, but that's what you have to do. I mean, I worked in the shop for literally 2.5-3 years without earning anything. I used to go and DJ at Dingwalls and play soul records, completely opposite what we're selling in the shop. But I love soul music, black music.
Yeah.
People are amazed I know anything about that. I think I only like, you know, Sonic Youth. I don't even like Sonic Youth.
So, have you...
I mean, what you're saying is the same thing that you're doing here, you know, the same way, the same... Why I feel a kinship with Vito Lito and why I'm here talking to you today is because I'm not a professional talker. I'm not retired, you know. I'm an A&R person. That's my job. I mean, I think people who do go around talking and giving lectures are like writers or poets are trying to sell their book, or people who have retired. And so this is a rare occasion that I'm doing it. But I'm doing it in tribute to you because I think you're just doing the same thing. And the Blue Coat is doing the same thing. It's just trying to create a community space and encourage the artists and people who otherwise maybe be too timid or feel alienated or just not know how to take those first steps into doing something, to give them that encouragement, really. You know, so it's that really, it's a way of being, isn't it? It's a way of being, which I think we all understand.
Yeah, I think
and also in these difficult times, it's more and more necessary, really.
And people, well, we do understand that. I'm going to take that juncture just because it was very kind words. I'm going to read you an email that Jeff sent us on the 2nd of March 2012. So we've been doing Beano for 2 years. And we'd never corresponded before, we didn't know each other. Hello, Craig. Just wanted to let you know that I'm really enjoying Go Music Magazine. Great name as well. We'll come to that in a sec. Liverpool is lucky to have you putting some much-needed energy into the new scene. All the best with it. Best, Jeff Travis. And at that point, I thought it was a wind-up first. We shut the office and went to pub. Celebration. But I think that, you know, there's amazing people out there within music who are running labels, and there's some really, really supportive people, but not everyone does that. And I think you... you know, you obviously see the positive encouragement and what that can do and how that can make sure that kind of people kind of feel that empowerment. So thanks. Well, then. okay, so let me ask you a couple of other things about this idea of kind of like the independent record label, the indie record label, has become something very, very different, I suppose, in many ways from what Rough Trade might have been at the start. I mean, what does the idea of an independent record label like mean to you now? I mean, what role do you see Rough Trade plays within the careers of your artists now? Is that the same as it might have been in the early 80s? Is it different?
You know, some people, you know, make an argument that you don't need a record label. You know, and I think if you see a lot of grime artists now, I think it's almost a rite of passage that you put out your music yourself. But what I'm starting to see is that those grime artists have done that, and then they're contemplating signing to a record label. And I think, you know, Sleaford Mods is a real example, because Sleaford Mods were doing amazingly well on their own. So you think, well, why do they need Rough Trade? What's Rough Trade going to bring to it? And we thought, when we went to see Sleaford Mods, you know, Jeanette and I, we just thought, let's just... I sent them an email, much like that one to you, saying, I really admire what you're doing. If you ever need any help, let us know. And Steve Underwood, who's the manager, said to me a year later, that was a very polite email. And I really liked it. And it turned out that Steve Underwood was actually a fanatical aficionado of Rough Trade. And he's got like the first 30 singles or something. So we got lucky in a way. And I think Jason and Andrew didn't have that sort of, you know, historical allegiance to the idea of Rough Trade. But Steve was quite excited about it. And so he invited Jeanette and I up to go and see them. And Andrew doesn't go to meetings. Andrew lives on a boat, you know, he lives on a houseboat with his partner. He just likes to go up and down the river. So he doesn't really go to business meetings. But Jason was there and Steve, and we met them in Nottingham. And, you know, what we really have to offer them is, first and foremost, because Rough Trade's part of Beggar's Banquet, we're part of a group with XR Records, 4AD Records, Matador. There's three labels and us. There's four labels inside a group. We're autonomous in terms of the A&R and the marketing, but we plug into Beggar's Banquet system worldwide. So what there is an incredible structure worldwide that really, if you're doing it on your own, you have a very hard job accessing. So that's really one of the primary things. Second thing is finance, to pay for an advance and to make videos and to pay for marketing, which takes the burden of that away from the artist. And thirdly, there is, if they want it, some A&R. And we have had some A&R input into Sleaford Mods record, and Jason has allowed us to give us his opinions. I mean, we're very careful, you know, to be nothing but respectful. And we are anyway with everybody. We only really give input. Well, actually, it's not always true. We give it when we're not asked sometimes. But you need to. That's your job, you know. That's your job. So I think that's it. And I think for some of the grime artists, I know some big grime artists are making record deals at the moment. Yeah. And I think it's the same thing. It's quite hard doing it yourself. You see, I think it's an incredible thing to do because I think you understand the mechanics of it. And there is so much work to it.
Yeah.
And I think pretty C-Power did the record before, lost themselves, and they just came in and said, phew, we had no idea. It was so difficult. But I mean, it's a good thing to learn, really, because you learn what happens. So, but I do think a record label can provide a lot, really. I think everybody needs an editor. You know, David Byrne famously said everybody needs an editor. He said that at the height of Talking Heads' success. So, I thought that was a good statement. I mean, you know, why do great artists put out bad records? You know, it's a real interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's because nobody... I mean, we once asked Chris Thomas. You know, Chris Thomas, the producer, produced Sex Pistols album, and Roxy Music, great albums, and loads of great records. And I remember Jeanette and I asked Chris, why did Elton John... We like Elton John. Why did he make so many terrible records? You're the producer. Why didn't you tell him this song is no good? And he said, if I'd have told him that, he would have fired me.
Yeah.
Well, I would think it's better to get fired, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, have you, over the years, I'm sure you have, kind of developed kind of like a particular kind of like... Obviously, every artist that you work with is fundamentally different. I imagine you adapt your approach depending on the artist that you're working with. But is there a kind of a toolkit of tactics that you've kind of developed over the years working with?
Tricks?
Yeah.
No, there's not really tricks. I mean, well, I suppose there is trick is you have to make the artist think it was their idea. That is fundamental. That is definitely it. Yeah, you have to really be clever with that. That is true, isn't it? Yeah, it's their idea. I mean, even if you plant the idea and they come to it, maybe, you know, 9 months later, that's good. I mean, the best artists you don't want, you know, I'm making it sound like we do a lot. Actually, the best artists, you just say thank you, amazing. That's all you say. You don't interfere. We don't walk around like some A&R go, you know, we just made the Peter Gabriel record. They didn't. They might have visited the studio for 10 seconds, but they didn't make anything. But I mean, that's the thing. I mean, with the Smiths, honestly, we didn't have to say anything, but this is great. I mean, until the moment when the Smiths and I diverged was when Morrissey said to me, here's our new single, Jeff. That joke isn't funny anymore. And I said, Morrissey, that's not a single. And he went, what do you mean? I said, well, that's a really good song and I like it. But it's not a single. And it's not a single. Go-Betweens was the same. I mean, it got to like 34 and everything else had got to number 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So, you know, I think I was right. Of course, they blame me. I mean, the Go-Betweens, you know, they made a track called, you know, Cattle and Cane is a great track. It's absolutely one of the best Go-Between tracks. And it's not really a hit single, but it's a gorgeous song, and it's got addictive qualities to it. It really is quite lovely. And so you could see it getting played on the radio, but it doesn't have the qualities of the hit single. But it came close, okay? So that set up a situation in the Go-Between's mind, Robert and Grant, that their next track was bound to be a hit because there was a kind of groundswell of commercial interest in them. And their next single that they made was called, a song called, I don't know if you remember it, called Man of Sand. And he just wasn't here. This doesn't sound like a hit. I had to say that to them. And that's quite tough, really. But that's when they kind of left to go to Beggar's Banquet. But you know, that's what happens.
What?
It's you've touched on.
You're the one jumping up and down like an idiot in a meeting, saying this is a hit record, and people look at me like he doesn't know what he's talking about. But, you know, it's a shame that even now no one believes me. I remember, you know, having an argument with our radio person, Edward Sharp. You know. It's a hit single, isn't it? Isn't it? What's it called, Kat?
Home.
Yeah, Home is a hit single. I mean, Home has been on nearly every advert ever in, played on a TV station and made a lot of money, but it's a hit single. It never got any radio play in England. It never got on the radio. And our plugger didn't even answer me when I said to him it's a hit record. I'm furious about it this day. Emiliano Cherini had a track called Jungle. It didn't get a single radio play in England. And a radio plug looked at me like I was an idiot. It was number one in Germany for 11 weeks. I mean, I think when you've lived in music all your life, it's like going to see a musician or an artist. You really have a sense of whether it's any good or not, because you've got a lot of comparisons to make. I mean, it is weird, isn't it, how different people have different opinions about something. I mean, you go to a show and you think it's incredible, and your girlfriend thinks it's awful. But, or, you know, someone you gone with, turn around, talk to them about it, and they've left, so they're at the bar chatting. And you just, you know, that's the strange, strange thing about art, isn't it? It just strikes people in different ways. But it seems to me that you can, I think, you know, the thing about Rough Trade is it's really not me, it's Jeanette and I together. And I've been lucky to have worked with Jeanette for 30 years. And she, you know, people know that she had a shop in King's Road. She's a London girl, North London. I went to school at the Angel. We have kind of have an affinity of being Londoners, being native-born Londoners. And when she was about 17, she left school and went to work at Acme Attractions, which was Don Letts' store on the King's Road. And, you know, there was two stores in London that were the apex of cool, and one was Sex, which was Malcolm McLaren and Vivian's shop. And a few hundred yards down the road was Acme Attractions. And that's where Jeanette started. And if you watch the Don Letts film that's on Sky Arts, came out about a week ago, there's lots of stuff in there with Jeanette in it. It's one of the best things Don Letts has done. A great period with John Lydon when they go to Jamaica, and the sound system culture in London, most of it. But, you know, so Jeanette and I have a kind of a chemistry where we actually think the same about music. And it's quite rare to have somebody that you have a kind of psychic connection with about music, that even without having to talk to each other, you know what you're thinking about. And that's something that we have, that kind of telepathy. And so the way that it works at Rough Trade, we only decide to do a project if we both agree. If she were to like something and I didn't, we wouldn't do it, and vice versa. I think if we felt passionate about it, it's never actually happened where someone has said, let's do that, and the other person has said, no, I hate it.
Really?
It's never happened. I think there's been occasions where maybe one of us has been a little less than 100%, and then we think, oh, well, you must be right. Because, you know, that's the respect we have for each other. But so that makes a big difference. So it's not on your own. I think on your own is a mug's game. I don't think you can do anything on your own. You know, I think everybody, like Joe Strummer says, everyone needs a bullshit detector, don't they? You know, and half the time we talk crap, so you need someone to tell you that. And so that's useful when you're in business and work. And also, you know, it's quite stressful running a label with lots of crazy musicians.
Wants to share the bed.
I forget the question. What was it?
I think you've definitely answered it. Right, we're going to take a short break at that juncture. 10 minutes. Charge your glasses. Stuart's going to play some records at the bar, and then when we come back, Jeff's